Welcome back to the program. Suppose we found out that most of what we know about history and what shapes it is wrong, that the traditional Manichaean worldview, that history marched forward on the feet of soldiers, is not the whole story. That, in fact, we didn't get to the globalized world of the 20th century via the battlefield alone, but through cooperation and a sense of our shared humanity. This is the view of my guest, esteemed historian David Cannadine. David was born in Birmingham, England, and educated at Cambridge, Oxford, and Princeton. He's the author of many acclaimed books, including The Decline and Fall of British Aristocracy. He is currently the Dodge Professor of History at Princeton, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about the undivided past, humanity beyond our differences. David Cannadine, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
It is so interesting in looking at your book and in realizing how we remember history and thinking back, for those of us that remember our school days, and thinking about being taught history almost always in the context of us versus them, that the inflection points always seem to be about battles and conflict and never a sense of that shared humanity you talk about.
Well, I suppose that's certainly a large part of the story, and what I've tried to do in this book is, of course, not to deny that war and battle and conflict and disagreement is certainly an essential part of human history. On the other hand, since we're still here, it can't be the whole of the story, and what I've tried to do in this book is to suggest that there is another story of conversations across these allegedly impermeable boundaries of conflicting identities, which is at least as much a part of the human story as the battles and the wars and the conflicts and the confrontations. I suppose it's, in a sense, to historians what good news is to journalists. It's the thing you kind of take for granted because it's not very interesting, and so you talk about other things that are more interesting, but actually it's arguably the most important part of what's been going on, and so I've tried to suggest that we maybe ought to give a bit more attention to it.
The interesting nugget inside that is the idea that in many cases these internal conflicts within groups and religion against religion and us versus them have been artificial constructs created by people in the heart of those conflicts in order to exacerbate the conflicts.
Well, it's certainly true that the target, I suppose, that this book has in its sights is rhetorical irresponsibility, perhaps of some historians, more importantly, because this is the audience to which it's addressed, journalists and pundits and especially politicians, religious leaders, who often throughout the course of human history have sought to talk up what they regard as absolutely visceral, primeval conflicts between different groups, and to suggest that the world is constructed in this polarized, binary, Manichaean way of us versus them. In the words of George Bush, if you're not with us, you're against us. And what I've tried to do in this book is to suggest that very often, not always, but very often, those descriptions of how the world is are utterly irresponsible oversimplifications, and should be very skeptically and critically viewed, which is, again, what in this book I've tried to do.
And in many cases, those adversarial absolutes, the us versus them, have been put forth very specifically by people who could benefit from that divide.
I think that's certainly true. I think that a lot of the rhetorical irresponsibility can be explained in those terms, and I think that part of what I've tried to do in this book is in some senses to contrast the rhetorical irresponsibility of people making those kind of inciting statements with the reality of most people's lives, which is actually getting on and coping often with people who seem in some senses very different, but that the reality of life for most people isn't often the conflicted, divided Manichaean life which many public figures and commentators want constantly to urge upon us that it is.
How much of it comes out of a lack of understanding of the other? That throughout history there has been this failure to understand people that are different than us, and it being a failure of thinking almost more than anything else.
Well, I think it's certainly true that one of the things that I want to encourage in this book is conversation and dialogue with people who seem to be different from ourselves. And very often it turns out on the basis of conversation and dialogue that they really aren't different from us at all. And that inventing and, as it were, insisting on these categories of difference, which might be religion or nation or class or gender or race, often results in hostilities and animosities which are in the end unjustified and are often in the end not the way that most people are living their lives anyway.
A particular irony of it is that in this 21st century world where we have so much more ease of communication and so many better ways to understand and interact with each other, that we still have large amounts of this polarization in all of these areas.
Yes, I think that's right. And certainly one of the targets of this book, a specific target, was this whole notion of the clash of civilizations, which Samuel Huntington made right. very popular in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and which was then recruited to provide a kind of global explanatory perspective in the aftermath of 9/11. And we had these two monolithic worlds locked in conflict, the West and Islam, one of which was utterly good, the other of which was utterly evil. Well, the West and Islam are both exceptionally complicated constructions, and to depict the world in that kind of cartoon caricature way doesn't seem to me to be a very sensible way to think about or talk about or derive policies for how we should go forward.
Talk a little bit about that in terms of Christianity, the West, and Islam, and ways in which so much of what we have believed about that us versus them simply flies in the face of what the reality is.
Well, the reality on one side, of course, is that since the days of the Reformation, and indeed in many ways since the days of the fall of the Roman Empire, Christianity has been an immensely varied religion with many different interpretations of the gospel and many different religious organizations and churches founded on the basis of that, which have often, as in the period of the wars of religion of early modern Europe, actually fought with each other, so that there is no such monolithic construct as Christianity. By the same token, Islam is a complex, varied, fissured world, Sunni and Shiite in one regard, covering a whole part of the world from Indonesia to Morocco, with various different ways of worship and with various different political organizations and with various different interpretations of the Quran. Some extremists, I don't deny, saying it's a doctrine of violence, many others taking a very different view that it's a doctrine of peace and accommodation. And, of course, in the end, Islam and Christianity actually worship the same God. So that, and what is more, historically, there is a long record of conversation and interconnection between Christianity and Islam, at least as much as there is a history of wars and confrontation. So that the whole relationship between Christianity and Islam is very complicated, partly because Christianity and Islam are themselves very varied religions, and partly because there's been a huge amount of creative and constructive dialogue between them. So to say that the only way to understand Christianity and Islam is a clash of two civilizations locked in perpetual centuries-long conflict is a grotesque distortion of the much more nuanced historical reality.
Is there simply a historical bias against complexity? That anything that takes into account the degrees of that nuance you're talking about just doesn't seem to catch on, if to use the popular phrase, in terms of that historical narrative?
Well, I think a lot of my fellow historians are very much aware of complexity and write about it all the time and don't feel that they can explain the past without stressing how complicated it is. I think that the problem with that is that quite often that complexity gets filtered out when historical accounts of episodes in the past are truncated and rendered more broadly accessible beyond the historical academy. I also think that there is a very strong predilection on the part of many journalists and pundits and commentators and politicians and public figures and leaders constantly to say the world is very simple, and the world is often very simple, it's divided between us and them. My view is that the job of historians is to say, no, the world is very complicated, and you ignore those complications not merely at your peril, but at our peril too. But complexity, nuance, is not perhaps the easiest of messages to get across, least of all, I think, in the world that we inhabit today, which, with the exception of programs such as yours, is increasingly strident and simplistic.
Even, I mean, as you say, even in present day, even in a contemporaneous framework, we still refuse to accept the complexity, even as it relates to the modern world, and that makes it all the harder in so many respects to transfer those ideas to a historical context.
I think that's true. I also think it's true that, in fact, the reality of most people's lives is much more complicated and nuanced than the simple, polarized version of us and them suggests. I mean, most of us are aware that we have many different identities, which we kind of live with and we negotiate, and we are kind of happy with that, and it's part of why life for many of us is worth living, because we do have many different identities. Whereas the us and them view of the world constantly insists that there's one identity that's more important than all others. Some say that about religion, some say that about nation, some say that about class, some say that about gender, some say that about race, some say that about civilizations. So there's a kind of growing discrepancy between the complexities, I think, and interconnections of the lives that most of us live and the simplified version of our identities that are often peddled in the media and in public discussion.
It made me think about how it relates to the arts and sciences historically, where there has traditionally been, like it or not, acknowledge it or not, a greater cross-pollinization between religions, between cultures, between groups.
Yes, I mean, I think that the arts and the sciences do tend to operate in a kind of international world which transcends the boundaries which might be religious or national or ethnic or whatever they might be. I think that's certainly true. I think there is a kind of republic of letters in the bit of the academic world that I'm lucky enough to live in the humanities, and I think that there is certainly a sense of global scientific cooperation. And those seem to me, on the whole, to be extremely good ways of arranging and structuring research in the arts and the humanities, and I think that's an admirable model.
In looking at, from a broad historical perspective, in looking at the history even in individual countries and conflicts within individual nations, there is the same tendency. I mean, it trickles down, so to speak, in terms of that refusal to accept nuance and complexity. So it's not unusual and not hard to understand how, when looking at the broad sweep of history, it simply has a multiplier effect.
Yes, I think that's true, but it's also fair to say that the fact remains that I suspect that for most people living their lives most of the time, their reality and certainly their preference is actually to get on with their neighbours rather than to be told that they should demonise them and hate them and kill them. And so I return to the point that I was making earlier, that there is a considerable and perhaps in our own time growing discrepancy between the messy, complicated, but rather rewarding reality of life for most people and the constant dynamic and imperative, as it seems, on the part of commentators and public figures to make the world seem much cruder, much more polarized, much more simplified. And I think that that's immensely regrettable. I mean, one can also cite contrary examples to that which seem to me to be extremely admirable, such as Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. Both of them have been presented as champions of civil rights for people of color, and certainly they both in part were, but the rhetoric of both of them was constantly concerned to extol and admire the brotherhood of man, the sisterhood of women across these allegedly impermeable boundaries of racial identity. And Martin Luther King famously said he wanted blacks and whites to sit down at the same table together. Nelson Mandela said he wanted South Africa to be a country of which the whole of humanity might be proud. And they took a much broader view of common humanity, and that's one of the reasons why I think they were both such admirable figures.
Does all of this run headlong into what some would argue is simply an innate psychological tendency, an evolutionary tendency in some respects, to want to associate with, to relate to people that are like yourselves?
Well, it's interesting that there's quite a lot of work being done in various branches of scientific research at the moment, which suggest that, in fact, that there is at least as much a predilection on the part of human beings to want to get on with each other and to accommodate to each other as there is a predilection to define ourselves against other groups. And I'm thinking here of the work of Steven Pinker, for instance, mm-hmm. who suggests that over the long run, human violence is diminishing and group conflicts are actually getting less. So although it may be true that certainly part of the human condition and part of human identities may be defined over and against other people, I don't think that's by any manner of means the whole of the story. And since, you know, we have lots of different identities, this notion that people are only to be understood in terms of one identity that's defined in this essentially adversarial way seems to me to be a gross oversimplification of a much more messy, but in some senses, I think, heartening reality.
Does it grow in some cases historically out of fear that when there are periods of time that there are greater inflection points, that it creates within individuals a greater fear, a greater sense of insecurity, which drives them to greater association with people like themselves?
I think that fear is certainly lies behind, as it were, putting the wagon trains in a circle, putting the wagons in a circle and waiting for the Native Americans to do their worst, if I can put it in that, appropriate example. I think that fear does encourage people to associate with those whom they think they know and to dislike those whom they don't know. And I certainly think, for example, in the aftermath of 9/11 here in the United States, there was a great deal of publicly pronounced fear, which made America for a time a much more paranoid and in some ways, I think, combative place. George W. Bush famously said, "He that is not with me is against me."
Right.
Well, the world actually on the whole isn't like that, and I don't think it was like that even in the aftermath of 9/11. Whereas I do think it is true that more confident societies or more confident individuals are very eager to encounter people who may look different from themselves, in part to see if they are different, but in part in the hope that, in fact, there is scope for establishing dialogue and conversation and common ground.
Which really goes to the heart of various national and cultural biases. I mean, some would argue, and I think I would share the argument, that there is a kind of paranoid streak in American culture and in American society that simply may not be present in other cultures and other societies, and that has a great deal of influence upon how we look at history as well as contemporaneous events.
Well, I'm a great admirer of a wonderful essay written in the early 1950s by the late, great Richard Hofstadter,
mm-hmm.
called The Paranoid Style in American
Apology,
History.
Right.
And he wrote it, I think, in the aftermath of McCarthyism. And it is one of those rare and remarkable historical essays, which was not only a brilliant account of what was going on at the time, but has also, as it were, been borne out by subsequent events. And I think that what Hofstadter was talking about there was an American fear of enemies, which, put another way, is an American desire to have enemies, and that one of America's problems since communism has ceased to be the enemy is it's not quite sure which enemy to go for. But as of now, for some people it's Islam, for some people it's Osama bin Laden's remaining followers, and that there is some peculiar attribute of the collective American psyche which is in some way paranoid. I don't think that's the whole of the story, and I don't think for one moment Hofstadter thought it was the whole of the story, and I'm not even sure it's unique to America. But I think his argument was well made about McCarthyism, which was a kind of collective outbreak of mm-hmm. paranoia, and I think that one could see in part the response to 9/11 as being the same.
And in many ways, the application is also to history, because where you stand, where you're viewing that history from, is certainly going to have an influence and an impact on the way you see that this Manichaean worldview or this divided or undivided past, as you say.
Yes, I think that's true, and I'm very struck, both in Britain and here in the United States, that one of the things that lies behind that point you've just made is the hugely continuing impact of the Second World War. The Second World War, on the whole, was a war in which the good guys were us and the Americans and the British, and the bad guys were the Germans and the Japanese, and the good guys won, and it was thought of like that, a very simple conflict between us and them, between good and evil. Now, in fact, of course, it was much more complicated than that. Soviet Russia was an ally, and I'm not sure that they were in the forefront of democracy and freedom, and certainly people living in Dresden or Hiroshima wouldn't have seen the war in quite those terms, nor would, I think, Japanese Americans and FDR in turn. Nevertheless, it is roughly fair to say that it was a good war fought by, certainly in Britain and America's case, good nations against bad nations. But it was, as such, a very unusual and exceptional war. And I think that one of the consequences of the Second World War is that people in the West are constantly eager to present whatever the latest conflict might happen to be in exactly the same way, such as the war in Vietnam, such as the war in Iraq, such as the war in Afghanistan. And I don't actually think that those wars are these existential conflicts between good and evil in the way that the Second World War was. And I think that to present them in that way is deeply misleading, and but very tempting if you're in power.
Very tempting, and also because it's very simple, because it doesn't involve complexity, as we talked about before.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And so you can then say, he that is not with me is against me.
David Cannadine, his book is The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. It's just out from Knopf. David, I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff, very much. It's been a huge pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we might have the chance to do so again sometime. Thank you so much.
Indeed, thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.